So I'd like to continue with the idea that practice has a lot to do with putting in place certain conditions. And when the conditions are there, then the path of practice unfolds, or the insights that are so significant along this path are revealed. And this combination of what we contribute to the practice, what we do and what we allow, what we do and how we're done to. We do the practice and the practice does us. And if you only think that practice is all about what I do, you'll reach a dead end. But if you only believe that practice is done to you, that somehow you open and the beneficent forces of the universe will take care of you, that's also a dead end. But this combination, balance between doing our practice, and then we do our part, then we get practiced. Then the Dharma works through us. And it's quite marvelous to get a sense or feel or experience of what can seem like the natural unfolding of things in a beneficial way. That there is somehow in our system, whatever that is, psychophysical system or human system, this world system somehow, there is patterns of unfolding, karmic patterns maybe, ways that things unfold based on causes and conditions that follow a kind of a natural course, or some people call a lawful course. So if we do unskillful things, that sets in motion a certain course of unfolding. If you have a good heart, then the natural unfolding will be regret or remorse. And if you do skillful things, then there's another unfolding that happens. And if your heart is good and open, then the good things you do will lead to feelings of, that come from that, feelings of exactly what those are, we don't know, but they tend to lead towards good states. Practice, if you act with wholesome intent, with generosity, then one idea is that that can bring joy to you, if you allow it to. So we do this practice in the same way. It kind of sets in course certain motions of things that then begin to unfold. And what I want to talk about today is how the core insights of insight meditation are something that are revealed when we put the conditions in place. And the core insights are the insights into impermanence or inconstancy, change. The insight into dukkha, suffering or unsatisfactoriness, unreliability. And the insight into not-self. And some people think that these insights are things you're supposed to believe. And then some people struggle with them. But for practitioners, they're things which are revealed. They appear to you in their own time. So you don't have to believe them. And it's not the job of a teacher to convince you that they're true. But the practices, one way of understanding the function of the practice, how we practice, is that we practice the opposite of the three characteristics. What we try to develop in ourselves is the opposite. And when we develop the opposites, then we set the conditions in place that the three characteristics can be seen. And so the opposites of the insight into impermanence, I think of as stability. The opposite of dukkha, or suffering, is well-being. And the opposite of not-self is confidence. Self-confidence, if you will. So, impermanence, we do some people a disservice if we insist, emphasize over and over again the teachings that everything's impermanent. Because some people have so little stability in their life that it just gives them no hope. It gives kind of depressing. People who grow up in war zones and not enough food and their family dies and they're refugees and yes, everything's impermanent. Not good news. But part of the function of the practice is to cultivate stability. And when I was thinking today about an image for stability, I thought about these massive, these majestic redwoods that we have here in these mountains. They've been standing for hundreds of years, strong, tall, dignified, firm, unmoving, just there, stable. I'm sure these redwoods have a lot more stability in their lives than you have in yours. They'll be around for a long time, probably. So it's kind of being rooted and stable. Or the image that's sometimes given for meditation is that of make your body like a mountain. Stability and solidness of a mountain just there. So somehow to create the conditions for physical and mental stability. And sometimes that's created by trying to create a stable life. Some people's stable life is found by finding a job, creating healthy relationships around them. That's what helps create stability. Sometimes stability is created by having an orderly life, not a lot of chaos. Cleaning your room might create help a little bit stability. Sometimes stability is created by coming on retreat. And for the time being of the retreat, something begins to settle and relax. And there's feeling that, at least for a little while, we're more settled or grounded in ourselves. Stability has some to do with relaxing. The image I have for someone who's trying to practice Buddhism while they're totally stressed out would be someone who's standing on their tippy toes, tall, straight on the tippy toes, trying to jump high. Kind of fragile, or you have a lot of stress, we're not really so stable. And so to learn to relax, to soften, to settle, to let go of the stress. Our whole system works better when there's no stress. You know, our minds work better, our health works better. And our spiritual life works better. It allows, you know, for a physical body, it allows the natural mechanisms of our body to function better when there's no stress. And we have amazing natural capacities that take care of ourselves all the time. So our hearts also have these natural capacities that work a lot better if we don't have the stress that's held everything tight or constricted. So stability and relaxation and groundedness. To sit quietly, stable, to create physical stability in your posture when you sit. It's very useful. So there's, and then with that physical stability, to sit upright, so there's, or lay upright, so that your spine is straight. And then letting the, keeping the spine kind of strong, then learning to like relax everything from there. So there's a combination of strength and relaxation. And that combination, you know, I think contributes to stability. And then there's mental stability. And that's one of the functions of concentration practices, is to help still the mind, make it stable, so it's not jumping around and racing around. And many years ago, I lived in a place that had a little cat, kitten, and it spent an inordinate amount of time chasing its own tail, running around and around. It never seemed to catch it, but it's always trying. Sometimes our minds are chasing something. I don't know if it's a tail, but just around and around. We never catch it. So, you know, it's not very stable. But to help the mind, to support the mind, to relax, soften, get to settle down. Relax, chill out, cool down. So the mind is not like choppy waters in a storm, but the mind is like a still, peaceful ocean with no waves. So learning to let go of our thoughts, learning to stay, you know, stay on the breath for a while, or on the steps as we do walking. There's a kind of stability, a steadiness. Steady yourself on the breath. Steady yourself in your posture. Steady yourself with on the steps as you walk. There's the idea of steadying yourself. Another word that I like connected to stability is composure. Compose yourself in your body. Compose yourself on the breath. Compose yourself on the feet as you walk. Compose your mind so it's settled, stable, kind of harmonized, organized, in balance. One of the ways to help stabilize or steady a fragmented, agitated mind is to not react to it, not to judge it, but to rather hold it in your awareness. Give it lots of breathing room, but hold it in mindful awareness. Something very powerful about knowing it's there. Because when the clear enough knowing, you're not stirring it anymore. As many of you know, if you stir up a muddy pond, the water doesn't settle. The mud doesn't settle. But if you don't stir it, it settles. So there's something about holding our difficulties in our busy mind, tensions we have, in kind awareness, and not reacting. It can help things quiet down, settle on their own. One of the most useful instructions I received about thinking in meditation was the instructions, don't be bothered by your thoughts. Just that, don't be bothered. I think that functions a little bit in this idea that the mud will settle if you leave it alone. If you're bothered, you're actually stirring it up even more. So we cultivate stability. And then we cultivate well-being. And I use the word well-being because I believe it's a very somewhat vague, broad word. And so all kinds of forms of well-being fit underneath that name. Joy and happiness and gladness and delight and contentment. Sweetness. So that we cultivate well-being. And when I was a new practitioner, I couldn't understand that, because any idea that you cultivate well-being, I only knew that to be something artificial. Like you're making yourself feel good? I mean, that doesn't seem real. But I think that you don't exactly make ourselves, but rather there are ways of supporting the arising of well-being. And one of them is to recognize the things that are you can appreciate in the present moment or appreciate it in your life. Recognize the goodness that's here. Recognize the things that you can be grateful for. Surely there must be something that you have in your life that warrants some gratitude and appreciation. But to avail yourself of that gratitude and appreciation more often, to open to it, to let it be here, let it kind of suffuse you or inform you or nourish you. Because whatever you think about frequently is going to help shape your heart and mind. So if you're frequently thinking about your neurosis, guess what? You become more neurotic. If you're constantly concerned with your desires and preoccupations, there's a subtle way, or not so subtle way, it kind of reinforces it. It's a little bit sad, you know, the way that chronic anxiety, which is a real condition that some people have, and you know, it creates the very conditions for us to be more dangerous, for have more danger in our life. Chronic anxiety creates the conditions for more anxiety. It's like when I first started to drive, I was pretty anxious, and so driving was dangerous because of the anxiety. So to find ways, loving ways, compassionate ways to settle the anxiety, to settle the distress that we feel. So one way is, as I said, is to open to what you can appreciate now. Take some time to appreciate beauty. Some people find it by going to the natural world. Appreciate the blue sky, or appreciate other people. And sometimes you can find joy in some of these things. And so to have appreciation, gratitude, joy, think of it as the salt, the soup of your life. It's good to add the salt sometimes. So what can you do for it? And then there's a kind of well-being that comes from what you do, the activities you do, and the classic one that Buddhism emphasizes is generosity. I think the expectation is that if you're generous, more generous you are, the happier you'll be. And that you can do, practice generosity to benefit yourself. But that requires that we kind of reflect on our generosity, think about what we've done in ways that we nourish us, that make us feel happy. And, oh great, that was nice. If we're generous and then so they want to thank you and you dismiss it, oh, it was nothing. You know, and you're kind of like, you know, create a big X, you know, stop, go away, don't thank me. You know, you know, I don't know if that's so conducive for your own happiness. If you're pushing it away, stop that. I don't deserve it. But to open and take it in and allow yourself to feel the delight and the joy of having done something nice and the delight and joy of benefiting someone. It's possible to have a lot of joy, a lot of happiness or contentment with having a path of practice that you can walk on, to have a practice, to have people to practice with, to have teachings that are meaningful. And there are people who spend a long time and never find it. Right now I'm thinking about, our group in Palo Alto, our IMC used to be in Palo Alto, and about 2001 we moved to Redwood City. And after we moved, there were people who came up kind of distressed, and they said, just this week I learned about you, and you're just around the corner from my house in Palo Alto, and now you're moving to Redwood City? You know, so, you know, we sometimes, you know, to finally have it, to learn to be connected, it's partly meant to be a source of joy and well-being, inspiration. In the suttas, the Buddha is described as, when he gave Dharma talks, he gave Dharma talks for the purposes of inspiring, softening, relaxing, opening, brightening people's minds. So does a dharma inspire you? So to do the kind of things, you got to start getting a sense of the kind of things that brings you well-being. And don't wait. And then when we practice meditation, for example, retreats, this also took me a long time to realize that it's okay to be happy. It's okay to feel joy and pleasure in the meditation practice. For many years, the teachings were, you know, kind of let go of that. That's not, doesn't count. Don't do that. We don't do that. And so I would just kind of bear on, endure more, you know, push ahead or something. Sometimes it can look like it's really good practice if you're grim. And so, but, you know, as at its own time, as we settle, there can start feelings inside of well-being. It could be simply from, after 4 days on the retreat, we finally feel the shoulders are relaxing and we're not carrying quite as much tension we had, and that feels good. Wow, that's nice. So good. So they're feeling relaxing and settling. Maybe the mind is not so preoccupied the way it used to be. And so it feels good. That's nice to have a mind not so preoccupied. So then the variety of sense of well-being can be right there in the meditation, and when it comes, to allow it to come, to allow it to be there, to allow it, make room for it. Recognize it. So much happens when we recognize things. There's something about the power of recognition, of knowing, of holding something in awareness that is like taking, maybe this is a bit terrible example, but taking the top off the jack-in-the-box. And then it has a chance to, you know, it's all this potential in there to unwind. And you know, so whatever needs to unfold will unfold if you take the top off. And so awareness is kind of like that. If you hold things in awareness, it makes room for whatever needs to unwind or unfold. And if it's joy, let it move through you. And then the third thing to develop in the practice is confidence, self-confidence, if you will. To feel a strong sense of a capacity to take care of oneself, capacity to engage, capacity to do the practice, capacity to walk through the world and know that you're not going to intentionally harm people, that you're walking through the world with integrity, confidence that when you talk to people that you're going to speak the truth. So have confidence in one's ethics is one of the places to develop confidence. And then to value that confidence, that surety, that sense, oh yeah, I can take care of myself in this ethical realm pretty well. Oh, like this. And then to develop some confidence in doing the practice. So maybe have some confidence that you understand what the instructions are. You know, that's part of the function of a teacher. You can go to a teacher and explain, this is what I'm doing, this is my understanding. And the teacher can say, great. And then you have some confirmation that, oh yeah, you can have confidence then. Or the teacher will say, nope. And then you can try again. But, you know, to have some confidence in that you know the teachings, you know something about the instructions, and then to develop slowly some confidence that you can apply it. And I think one of the great treasures of my life is the confidence I've had now in mindfulness. That if I can be mindful, then there's something I can trust whatever situation I'm in. There's something about being mindful that's very powerful. I don't know if everything is trustable if I'm not mindful, but if I'm mindful, there's something. And many, many times in my life, I haven't known what to do or haven't known how to find my way through things. And just coming back to the mindfulness and being present, I'm kind of in awe of how often just that sense of openness and presence, and that some kind of inner process of wisdom, understanding, unfolding, begins to move and happen. And I've had that with retreats as well, where it seemed like the retreat was really hard for me, but I just knew, I had a lot of confidence in the practice. I know it works. I don't know when it works, or when it's going to work. I know it was going to work. So I kind of relax and just do the practice, and sometimes the practice feels like manual labor. You know, like, there we go again, shoveling dirt. It's just real like manual labor. That, you know, it's not very rewarding, you know, with all spiritual feelings and nice and joyful and cozy. But that's how it is sometimes. And I've learned when it's like that, then it's just like that. I don't make a big deal of it. But I trust the practice. I just have to keep doing it. And I have confidence in it. And then lo and behold, at some point, something shifts. So to have confidence, to have some confidence that you know yourself, There's some confidence you know yourself about how you are in challenging situations. You've studied yourself. You know in challenging situations how you tend to instinctually respond. And you learn something about wise ways of responding to challenging, unpleasant situations. It doesn't mean that you solve them, but maybe you've learned how to be stable, how not to be reactive. Maybe you're just confident you've known how to keep your mouth shut. For some people, that's pretty good. I know how to do, you know, you're going to the big holiday party with all your relatives. And you know how to not say things. You have confidence in that. So this confidence, self-understanding, certain kind of self-mastery, maybe is slowly gained, but it's part of what practice is developing. So with these three in place, stability, well-being, and confidence, then there's a kind of a platform with which to see clearly. And I think of these three as the legs of a tripod that holds a telescope or a microscope or whatever. And so, you know, it's hard with holding a big telescope in your hands and looking at a star or the moon because you can't hold it still enough. But you need a tripod to hold it still. And so we hold the tripod, you know, these three things hold our, you know, create a tripod for us. And so we can be still. So we can gaze clearly. We can look upon things or see, observe what's happening with steadiness, with a sense of well-being, enough well-being that when what we look upon is difficult, we're not overwhelmed by it. And we look at upon with confidence. So again, so when it's difficult, that we have something we can rely on, our confidence. Yes, I can stay with this. It's okay. And so then, with this tripod and this ability to observe in a clear, steady way, when the conditions are ready, then we can begin to see and appreciate the impermanent nature of phenomena. And it begins to stand out more in highlight. And the impermanent nature is that of arising and passing. Things arise and things pass. Things arise and things pass. And part of the impermanent nature is the unfolding, the evolution of how things unfold. The gift of impermanence is that some things don't change lawlessly, they change lawfully, they change according to a pattern. And so the deeper kind of unfolding of practice is a kind of a norm, it's a very, very well understood sequence of things that unfold one after the other, the deepening of practice. So it's impermanent and it changes for our benefit as it moves along. So to start appreciating and seeing impermanence and change, not as an enemy, but as something that brings wisdom, understanding, that allows something deep to unfold. It's often said that the deep insight into how things are changing is a support for letting go. But it makes a lot more sense to let go if you feel stable. If you let go when, you know, if you're up on the edge of Half Dome and holding onto the railing and it's blowing like crazy and they say let go, off you go. But if you have real stability and you're strongly rooted, maybe you can let go of the railing and you stand there. So, you know, so having something to hold you. So you're not just letting go and just, there's nothing there. And then the second insight is the insight into dukkha, suffering or unsatisfactoriness, unreliability. It means a variety of different things. When I was practicing Vipassana in Burma, I had a period of time where I felt a lot of happiness in my meditation. It was very still and very quiet, and that stillness and quiet, the stability, allowed me to see more clearly what was going on in my mind than I ever had before. And I saw that every time I had a thought, even the most innocent kind of nothing kind of thought, there was a very subtle kind of tension or pressure or kind of dukkha, something that wasn't, felt a little bit off. And but you know, I could feel that subtle suffering in this field of well-being. It was okay to feel it. But the big thing was that I had this kind of this turning in my mind suddenly, and I really, if this is true for me, then there's so much more suffering in the world than I ever realized. I knew there was a lot of suffering, but boy, if it's there right in how people think, boy, there's a lot of suffering. And I was kind of overwhelmed by, not overwhelmed, but I was just amazed by the tremendous amount of suffering. It kind of, my heart and compassion just kind of spilled out. But it was all being held in this field of well-being. So this clear seeing of suffering in the world and then being held by something. To see the suffering of the world, if it gets held by your own suffering, it can just do us in, be too much. So to create the context to hold these deep insights is very important. And then this insight into not-self. It's very important to realize that it's not a belief system. It's not something you have to believe. Let it come on its own, in its own good time. But at some point in your life, you've understood some things that are, you've loosened up on some of the things that you take to be yourself. You realize, oh, that's not really who I am. When I was 13 and 14, who I really was how long my hair was. And that has been an inordinate amount of time concerned about that. And I can tell you that I no longer have that particular... I'm content to say my hair is not myself. I don't define myself by it. And then, you know, maybe earlier in your life you defined yourself by your clothes or your job or your relationships or your, you know, all kinds of, your car or your house or your political philosophies, your opinions. And then as we grow up, we tend to outgrow some of these things. One of my great teachers in my life was my great-grandmother. I didn't spend a lot of time with her, but I lived in her little, teeny little apartment. I had a teeny room on the side. And she had a living room, a teeny kitchen, and her bedroom. And I had a little room on the side I stayed in. So sometimes I went to see her in her living room. And she would be sitting in her... I don't think it was a rocking chair, but the kind of soft, easy chair. And she had all this lace everywhere, and lace curtains, and lace in the little round table, and she probably had made it herself. And she would just sit there, and I don't know what was going on in her mind, but what I experienced was, here was a person who was completely, didn't have to be anything for anybody, was content, settled, at ease. Maybe she'd seen so much. And to be in the presence of someone, for me, who I felt was just there, didn't have to prove anything or be anything or get anything or want anything from me, just was there in an open, kind way, was so powerful for me. So as we grow up, you know, as we get older, we let go of a lot of things we thought, well, this is who I am. And some of this, we mature as we get older, and sometimes our physical fitness as we get older is not what we want anymore, but it changes, right? And so then we stop defining ourselves by our physical fitness, and all kinds of things change. So Buddhist practice is a little bit like premature aging. Now, we don't usually advertise that. So it's premature aging in the sense that we're learning how to recognize these things that we take to be myself. That doesn't really work so well anymore to do that. And we start realizing it earlier before we get to be 88. Not this. And there's a, so then who am I? I have to be someone. But then we have that inner confidence that holds it. We have this kind of confidence and strength like a redwood tree. We don't have to understand who I am. We know what we feel, we know what we think, we know what's happening, we know how to respond, we know how to be present. We have all the tools we need. We don't have to then define it or put a label on it or wrap it up in a wrapper of, I am this, this is myself. We can take care of ourselves. And so this deep insight into not-self, which can be disorienting for people because it's so different than how it usually is in our lives to be without this usual reference point, but we have the confidence that it's okay. So we're cultivating the opposite of the three characteristics. We cultivate stability, well-being, and confidence. And then we let the three characteristics take care of themselves. They'll show themselves in time. And as they show themselves, each of those provides an opportunity to let go, to release ourselves from the clinging and the grasping, the resistance that comes from thinking that things are permanent, or at least enduring. That kind of reactivity that we have because we think that, we focus on wanting happiness or getting happiness from the world. And we realize, no, the world is unreliable for a really stable sense of well-being. You can't get a lasting, safe happiness from the world itself. That can't be done. But there is well-being here. There is happiness and joy that can be found. And so let go of wanting our partner, or wanting our house, or wanting our this and that, or wanting a job, and all these things. We let go of wanting it to do it for us. If I only can have that, then I can be happy. If only I can have that, then I can be happy. Not a few people have gone through a life, if only I can have this, then they get it. Only if the next thing. Next, because it's not quite enough. And so this letting go. And then in the very act of letting go, of releasing, enjoy it. Feel the delight, feel the lightness, feel the goodness of not clutching the fist anymore, clutching the heart. Feel how nice that feels. Start appreciating. It isn't just a loss when we let go. We also gain. So we let go. And then we let go of, all the ways in which we tie ourselves in knots around self-identity issues. concerned about what other people think about us and trying to prove ourselves or be someone. And we loosen up, we let go. But letting go is not just about what we lose, what we let go of. Because the conditions are in place, we also let go into. So the opportunity is that you don't just, you know, if you let go of the diving board, you let go into the pool on a hot day. It's so nice. If you let go of your clinging, you might have something that you fall into, that you settle back into, something you recognize, oh, there's peace here. So you let go into the peace. You let go into the well-being. You can let go into the stability, because one of the ways to be unstable is to cling. And it can seem like stability, but it's a stability of ice that's frozen. And it, you know, it's brittle. So to let go into, to recognize what's here that's good. Do you have something here? Do you have joy, well-being, confidence, peace, calm, love, compassion, appreciation, gratitude? What's here? And so when you let go, you can settle back into that. Let go into the Dharma, or let go into the trust you have, the confidence you have. You know, the trust you have. Some people will say that they trust life, so you know, settle and let that trust in the Dharma move and unfold. And to practice this practice of mindfulness and Buddhism for a long time, one of the rewards of that is to see over and over again how trustable it is to let go and let go into the Dharma, let go into the practice, let go into the goodness. And then the natural unfolding, as I talked about the other day, the natural flow of the river, of the rainwater down the hillside, down the mountain, down to the ocean. That image of how practice unfolds, like a river flowing down river, downhill, has a chance to begin to occur. So I believe that these are a lot of words and ideas for this point in the retreat. Sitting quietly and peacefully. And so I want to mention that, a lot of words, ideas. But the purpose of them, the intention I hope to have, was to come to the end of the talk and hope that listening to these, you would be, if you were applying them to yourself as we sat here, you'd be more stable. You would feel a little more sense of well-being. Maybe you had a little more confidence. Maybe you were willing to let go a little bit into yourself, so you can settle back in to your body, to your seat. Let go of focusing a lot on what I'm saying, and let go into being aware from the inside out in this wonderful, precious being, body that you are here. And perhaps hearing the words of letting go, rather than being dismayed of hearing a Buddhist teacher talk about letting go one more time. To see that how much it could be for your own benefit, that we let go of that which is not beneficial, and we get a chance to let go into something wonderful. And so to begin appreciating that the ways in which you feel tight in your brain, that you're holding on, that you can loosen up, loosen your mind, soften it. That the ways in which you hold your heart protected and closed, that you can let go, you can loosen, open up. That you can trust what's in there, and trust the unfolding. In the way that you hold your body tense, you can let go. And so that you begin to trust the tremendous value of letting go. And with stability and well-being and confidence, you'll know how to take care of yourself. You'll figure it out. You're not left protectionless when you let go. If you develop these three qualities, then when you let go, you'll know how to be in the world. So to let go. So as we sit here and return now to silence, you might consider, what can you let go of? What are you inspired to let go of? What would make sense for you to release?